The title of the book is No Ashes in the Fire, Coming of Age Black and Free in America. And the title is a literal reference to a moment that I experienced as a young person growing up in Camden, New Jersey. I was a sort of gender-bending, gender-variant boy. I got picked on a lot because of the ways that I moved my hands and the ways that I walked, the ways that I talked, the fact that I hung out with a lot of girls, the fact that I deviated from all of the rules, I guess, and norms that boys are told they ought to follow. And in an event on one day, some boys from the neighborhood, including my neighbor, surrounded me on the street and physically assaulted me. But during that process, one of them took a gallon of gasoline and emptied it on me and attempted to light a match, but the match didn't light. And eventually an aunt came outside and saw this happening and intervened. So in so many ways, it was a reference to that moment where there could have been a fire, there could have actually been death. It was a reference to me having made it through that and having come out the other side alive. But it's also a reference to, I think, what it means to be Black within the context of the U.S.
I'm your host, Michelle King, and you're listening to The Fix, a podcast that shares the stories of women and men who are innovating and taking action to advance equality in the workplace and beyond. In 1915, half a century after the 13th Amendment abolished slavery in the United States, Harvard-trained historian Carter G. Woodson and prominent minister Jesse E. Moreland founded the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History, an organization dedicated to researching and promoting achievements by Black Americans and other peoples of African descent. Known today as the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, the group sponsored a National Negro History Week in 1926, choosing the second week of February to coincide with the birthdays of Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. The event inspired schools and communities nationwide to organize local celebrations, establish history clubs, and host performances and lectures. In the decades that followed, mayors of cities across the country began issuing yearly proclamations recognizing Negro History Week. By the late 1960s, thanks in part to the civil rights movement and growing awareness of Black identity, Negro History Week had evolved into Black History Month on college campuses. President Gerald Ford officially recognized Black History Month in 1976, calling upon the public to seize the opportunity to honor the too often neglected accomplishments of Black Americans in every endeavor throughout our history. Since 1976, every United States president has officially designated the month of February as Black History Month. Other countries around the world, including Canada and the United Kingdom, also devote a month to celebrating Black history. So in celebration of Black History Month, today we'll be hearing from Darnell Moore, an award-winning writer, a leading Black Lives Matter activist, and an advocate for justice and liberation. Darnell's list of accomplishments are just too long to name here. But among them is his incredible book, No Ashes in the Fire, where he shares his experience growing up as a scared, bullied teenager who not only survived, but found his calling. Darnell's story is incredibly powerful, and it serves as a reminder to all of us that liberation is possible if we commit our lives to fighting for it. Darnell Moore grew up in poverty to teenage parents living in New Jersey. He battled with his personal identity as both Black and queer, and in amongst all of this, Darnell had to endure a terrifying, life-threatening experience, which shaped who he is today. Here he shares his story.
The title of the book is No Ashes in the Fire, Coming of Age Black and Free in America, and the title is a literal reference to a moment that I experienced as a young person growing up in Camden, New Jersey. I was a sort of gender-bending, gender-variant boy. I got picked on a lot because of the ways that I moved my hands and the ways that I walked, and the ways that I talked, the fact that I hung out with a lot of girls, the fact that I deviated from all of the rules, I guess, and norms that boys are told they ought to follow. And in an event on one day, some boys from the neighborhood, including my neighbor, surrounded me on the street and physically assaulted me. But during that process, one of them took a gallon of gasoline and emptied it on me and attempted to light a match, but the match didn't light. And eventually an aunt came outside and saw this happening and intervened. So in so many ways, it was a reference to that moment where there could have been a fire, there could have actually been death. And I often think about what goes through the mind of a young person who detests someone so much that they are willing to try to sort of snipe their life out. So that's a literal reference. It was a reference to me having made it through that and having come out the other side alive. I mean, I had to go to the hospital, but it could have been worse. I was certainly psychologically harmed. But it's also a reference to, I think, what it means to be Black within the context of the U.S. Black people have always lived through the fire that is white racial supremacy in this country. So for me, it was also a way to use it as a metaphor to say the fires, though they exist, and you know, certainly white racism is not just one fire, that's the fire of homophobia, the fire that comes because of our antagonism to people who are genderqueer, and the fire that comes that is sexism and patriarchy. And for anyone who knows what it feels like to exist in the everyday fires that we set upon one another, we know what it also feels like to sort of be victorious, too, in some occasion. So that said, like, that is where the book title came from, and it was my way of trying to make a larger point about what it means to survive. And surviving doesn't necessarily mean that the fire is no longer there. It just means that some of us figure out how to make it through. And unfortunately, some of us don't.
African Americans are, and have always been, a vibrant part of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer community. From trailblazing pioneers such as openly gay novelist James Baldwin and transgender rights activist Marsha P. Johnson, to modern-day heroes such as actress Laverne Cox and basketball star Jason Collins, LGBTQ African Americans have made enormous contributions to the ongoing fight for social, racial, and economic justice. There are more than 1 million LGBTQ African Americans currently living in the United States, with approximately 3.7% of all African American people identifying as LGBTQ. Like so many LGBTQ Americans, growing up, Darnell encountered daily discrimination, resulting from racism, classism, and homophobia, as well as a combination of all of these. To understand inequality, we have to start with unpacking our different experiences of it. Here, Darnell shares why this is so important.
One of the gifts that Black feminism has given us are a bunch of ideas connected to our need to hold a political vision, to hold a vision of a people, of individuals, of collectives, that doesn't disaggregate identities, lived experiences, that doesn't disaggregate humanity. We are all more than one thing. So some of those keys that we've given, like the Combahee River Collective, for example, they talked about in that the term that was used is the simultaneity of oppressions, right? This idea that at once all of these sort of vectors of identities are interrelated, they're interconnected. You know, I can't strip my Blackness from my maleness, from my queerness, from my working class upbringing, from the fact that I grew up on the East Coast, which is a very specific geography, and in the East Coast in New Jersey, which is one of the wealthiest states with some of the poorest urban centers, right? So I grew up in one of those urban centers and went to schools that were highly, highly under-resourced. I mean, all of those things are sort of contingent, are connected, and make me who I am. Some other language that we've been given, you know, Kimberlé Crenshaw, very early on, specifically talking about the experience of a Black woman she was really writing within the legal framework and talking about Black women, particularly within, you know, the welfare state and so forth and so on, coined the term intersectionality to get us to think about the ever-present interconnection between all of who we are. And if we all are honest and did sort of a breakdown of our, not only our identities, but the ways that those identities can provoke harm or various forms of discrimination in our lives, and or safety, and or access to wealth, then we would do better at not trying to sort of parse our identities.
The violence Darnell experienced growing up, with Nelly being set on fire, is all too common in America. According to a 2014 report on hate violence, Black LGBTQ people are twice as likely to experience any physical violence, twice as likely to experience discrimination, and 1.4 times more likely to experience threats, intimidation, and acts of hate. This is what makes men like Darnell truly remarkable. He's taken the hate and violence he encountered and not only endured it, but he's turned it into something beautiful, his life's work.
It's interesting, and I wonder if you feel this way too, but I feel, you know, I have a background, you know, in religion and ministry. And, you know, I studied at a seminary, and I went into seminary because I felt a profound call, we would call it, a profound move to do my part to make the communities in which I'm part more equitable, more safe, better. So in so many ways, like, my background of growing up with the family that I did, who taught me about radical love and community, in a community itself that was, in so many ways, literally set ablaze because of economic blight and political sort of maneuvering that had stripped Camden of its virtue in so many ways. Like, growing up, when you are in conditions of sort of scarcity, I don't know, I became something of a dreamer. In other words, like, scarcity is never ever a good thing, but in some ways it sparked my imagination, or at least pushed me to want to do something for the people in which I live next door to. When you get touched by injustice and it literally impacts your life, it can turn you into something of a, I don't know any better way to say it, but this work for me is a call that's very much, it's something that I don't have a choice to do, because I don't want anyone, especially young people, having to live in the traces of a lot of the traumas that I experienced. I want them to live free of economic disenfranchisement, poverty, of lack of safety, of the type of hatred that some of us are prone to mete out. So I try to put all of my energy in things that are going to result in the good for other people. And every aspect of the work that I do, whether that's writing, whether that is public engagement work, whether it's organizing, whether it's research, whether that is working within large or small companies, our NGOs are working across the world, like, it's all connected to that. And to the extent that I don't feel that, I won't be part of it.
One of the things that makes Black History Month so powerful is it disrupts denial. When we celebrate the achievements of Black Americans, we must also acknowledge what makes these achievements even more remarkable is that Black Americans don't just work hard, they do so while overcoming a system of inequality. This system still exists today, which is why it is so important that every white person explores what it means to be white in a country that values whiteness above all else, and the numerous challenges that this creates for everyone else. Exploring this also reveals how we're complicit in creating or upholding a system of racism, which ensures the continual unequal distribution of resources, treatment, and value assigned to people based on race. So while white people like me may be against racism, we still benefit from the unequal distribution of resources controlled by other whites, which requires the continued discrimination and marginalization of Black people. Being white, my work is to understand my privilege and change a system of inequality by understanding how I often create, uphold, and benefit from it. Not just for one day or one month, but for life.
Part of what I wanted to do in writing the book was to show people that we are never, ever not disconnected from our histories. That we are actually living in a rearticulation of old ways of being, of old hatreds, of old forms of bias, of old systemic forms of denial, and not just denial, but literal, willful things that have been done to sort of keep vulnerable people from access, from safety, from well-being. Racism and sexism and misogyny and greed, these are things that are resonant in both our past and our present. And unless we're able to sort of raise our awareness about them, they will be present in our future. In many ways, America is built on all of it. I always say that in the U.S., we love to lie. And by that, I don't mean that to be disingenuous. I mean, we don't like sitting with the complicated truths that have made this country what it is. I mean, it's built upon, it's a settler colonial state that is, it was a home to indigenous people whose land had been warred away from them. It was built off of the blood and sweat of human people trade, enslaved black people, enslaved African people. I mean, we can go on about all the ways that, you know, women have been disenfranchised in this country. And when we think about sort of notions of this idea of all men being created equal, literally meaning men, literally meaning some men, white men. I mean, this is the foundational tenets of our country. And rather than deny that, we have to sit with it, but we don't want to. You know what I mean? We get really uncomfortable sitting with it. And we like to dismiss it and say, oh, but that's only in the past. All of those things have resonances in our economic system, in our political system. We have yet to have a woman president, right? We just had our first black president just over the last several years. I mean, I can go on and on with the ways that wealth has sort of been withheld from certain bodies of people within this country. So we are never, ever, ever disconnected from our past. And what I try to do in the book is to offer some sort of social context, some social historical context, to remind people that all of these sort of traces of old bigotries and new hatreds are always present in every aspect of our lived experience, including our relationships to one another.
One of the most important things to do in this work, I believe, is to realize the great privilege that it is to be able to dismantle inequality that you yourself might never have to experience. Too often we glorify people who tackle inequality or see these people as helping others, but they're not. We're simply removing the barriers that we put in place, and doing this actually serves our own interests, as Darnell explains here.
Bell Hooks, who I name as a big sister, as a mentor, as a friend, and as someone who I've learned from, like, her idea about feminism is that it is not, it's actually a liberatory project for men too. Because once I realized that patriarchy doesn't just have harm women, but also really crushes, or at least make small my humanity as a man, a person who is identified as a man, and then I would realize that something like feminism, that big F word, right, is not something that will harm me, but it actually will free me. And in the same way, you know, I tell folk all the time, you know, I had a conversation with a friend who was saying, you know, like, black people, the disadvantage is that, you know, you pretty much have to sort of like grow up with this sort of cloud of like white supremacy. And I said, actually, as James Baldwin has said more eloquently than me, white racism is more a problem for white people because it actually diminishes your humanity, right? And by you, I'm speaking generally, right? It diminishes the humanity of anybody who buys into it, of anybody who buys into a lie, of anybody who buys into a facade. So in other words, being anti-racist is not only about removing the barriers and the systems and the ideologies that harm black folk or Latinx folk or Asian folk. It's also about white folk gaining more of their humanity, more of their self, more of their freedom, more liberty from the thing that is a lie that we have been told to believe.
Tackling racism starts with each of us. We must do the work to understand our own biases, prejudices, and racist beliefs. This starts with letting go of the need to be a good person or to be right. I've seen too many examples of where the term racist or racism is somehow seen as worse than the racist behavior. Even with the best intentions in the world, we can be unaware of how we benefit from a system of inequality and through our own inaction, actually uphold it. Or how our views and beliefs might even be shaped by it. This lack of awareness is the starting point for tackling all forms of inequality.
I do believe that self-reflectivity is key. And I don't just mean that individually, I mean that sort of collective reflection, sort of reckoning might be a better word, self-reckoning. And what I mean by that is I often say it's very easy to sort of name whose feet are on our necks. It's very easy to rage on about the ways that we might experience individual or collective harms that are personal to us. It is not easy naming the necks that our feet are on. And that is what I mean by being self-reflective. It's a metaphor, but what I'm trying to say is that all of us, if we are honest, have our feet on somebody's neck. And it requires a bit of self-awareness, of self-reflexivity, and reckoning to undo that, because I feel like we're in a state where that's what we do. We rage, we point the finger, you know, we can say, oh, this person is impressing me. Here are the ways in which I'm being harmed. It's not easy for any of us to say, and I haven't seen this type of collective reckoning in sort of the U.S., of us saying, and here are the nets upon which my feet are placed. And then the harder work is after you figure out that your feet are up on somebody's net, you got to take them off. That is the work of repair, right? That is the work of real true equity. I mean, that's the reckoning. And that is what I think is the answer to communal, social, economic transformation, and even more, individual sort of transformation.
I am so tremendously grateful for the opportunity and privilege to hear and learn and reflect on the experiences of Black people in America, like Darnell Moores, my great colleague and friend. Darnell's advice to all of us is to use this moment to reflect on what it means to be free. When we think about freedom, or what he calls the freedom dream, we need to consider who's in it, who's alive, who's taken care of, and then who isn't. And most importantly, what each of us can do to make freedom material for all men and women. Because this is what equality is, and it starts with each of us. I really hope you enjoyed today's episode. Feel free to share this with your boss and colleagues, as this is an issue that affects all of us. Before I go, just to mention, if you're interested in partnering with us or being a guest on the show, then please reach out through our website, thefixpodcast.org. You can also sign up to our weekly newsletter and contribute your story there. Thanks again, and I'll catch you all again next week.